This edition of The Recap was first broadcast on the 26th of September 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello, I'm Ben Rylan, and welcome to The Recap, bringing you the highlights from the past week's live news and analysis programs broadcast right here on Monocle 24. Over the next half hour, I'll bring you some of the very best interviews and reports from The Globalist, The Briefing, Midori House, and The Monocle Daily, and of course, The Ten. Coming up in the program...
Very many people actually do appreciate a lot of the aesthetics of these products. Behind that, though, is there's a very strong mission of the overall idea of what Punkt is about.
As the London Design Festival kicked off, we were in the thick of it at Somerset House for a live broadcast. Then we turn our focus to NATO as our executive editor Steve Bloomfield joins Jens Stoltenberg during his visit to Ukraine. Also ahead...
There are reasons to believe that this is not just an attempt, but it is a real and concrete effort that is being given some results along these 3 years of negotiation.
As the Colombian government ends the longest-running insurgency in Latin America this week, we spoke to the country's ambassador to the UK and learnt how the peace deal was brokered. All that and much more coming up in the next half hour here on The Recap with me, Ben Rylan. We kick off this week's edition of The Recap with a highlight from our daily discussion program, Midori House. On Monday, the show was broadcast live from Somerset House to celebrate the launch of the London Design Festival. Handsome ideas and fresh conversations took centre stage as host Robert Bound sat down with Petter Nebbe, the man behind the sleek tech design firm Punkt. They chatted about his mission to tame technology and streamline our lives through simple innovation.
It's a mobile phone that focuses, boils down to the essentials of what the phone should be doing. Good to have a conversation with. The necessity of this phone has been in the works for quite a long time. And the mobile phone is our fifth product, the fifth product that comes in and probably more clearer communicates what Punkt are doing.
So this is very much kind of like your flagship product then, I
suppose. Absolutely, yes.
And just tell us a little bit about the history of Punkt, because, you know, it's not like you're a company that was formed 6 months ago and you have five products. We were saying before we went on air, actually, that every company that's 2 years old has 500 products just to make sure they're scrambling around into every single market that they can get their hands on. It's not a great sign of confidence, often. So tell us about when you guys were born and why you only have five products, why this is only the fifth.
Right, first of all, you know, we are very serious about our products. That means that we don't want to make just a product for product's sake. And we sort of we have built and structured our organization in that way that we can afford to do so. So quite agile in creating partnerships rather than fixed costs. So that's sort of on the basis of an organization for doing so. So there is no true demand for just, you know, you have to go out there because you have to make a living. That's one part. You know, a company like Punkt, we have to do meaningful things. And it starts from meaningful, you know, purposeful business, so to say. And even though it's consumer electronics and there are, so to say, beautiful objects, I think very many people actually do appreciate a lot of the aesthetics of these products. Behind that, though, is there's a very strong mission of the overall idea of what Punkt is about. And that is really about giving people's instruments to control and manage a little bit more technology. Today we are a little bit overtaken and we are more steered by technology than us steering technology. So therefore, you know, about time then and the long time it takes to make product that are meaningful, has some kind of purpose, and also are actually beautifully to look at and hold in their hand, takes a long time.
And this is the idea as well, presumably, that, you know, you've made a product here with your first mobile phone, the first Punkt mobile phone, that that actually sort of takes options away from people. It makes people have conversations in real life because you can't have them on WhatsApp, presumably. You can't have an Instagram account when you're on this. You can't be on Facebook or Twitter. The idea is that you're giving people some time to actually have proper conversations and use their mobile phone to send a text, to phone their wife, to do whatever it is.
To converse.
To converse.
Yeah, yeah.
So I mean, we tend to think that good design is that it comes from necessity. You know, necessity is the mother of invention and all the rest of it. So really, you've invented technology that takes us away from technology.
Yes. technology is supposed to be there servicing us.
Yeah.
And I think technology is great. I think technology is doing, you know, fantastic things for humankind, you know, really. And I am 100% for, you know, all technology that can do that. And I think, for instance, the center of today's destruction, for instance, is the smartphone. It's a beautiful piece of technology, has so many qualities to it. But the problem today is probably we have sort of been taken with the pants down because we haven't really have any social structure or how to deal with such a powerful thing that sits now on every table or in the pocket. Meaning that it's really more, you know, we get these push information to us all the time. We have lost the ability to focus and do one thing because it's the endless set of attraction that sits in this squared or rectangular piece of technology. So, yes, I think, again, as you said, you know, for me, technology is there to service us, but we are currently, in a way, servicing technology.
That was Petter Nebbe there, founder of Punkt, speaking to Monocle's Robert Bound in a highlight from Midori House, live at Somerset House. You're listening to The Recap on Monocle 24. Now, on Tuesday, we headed to Ukraine, where the head of NATO was paying a visit and trying to satisfy his hosts without antagonizing the neighbors. Jens Stoltenberg became the first NATO General Secretary to sit in on a National Security and Defense Council meeting in Kiev. He's set to witness the signing of a new doctrine, which identifies Russia as a military aggressor. Our foreign editor, Steve Bloomfield, was on the trip with him. Ty Genright checked in with him on Tuesday's edition of The Globalist.
If you're speaking to the Ukrainians, they say that this is a key moment that really cements the relationship between Ukraine and NATO. They point to the joint training exercise, which was inaugurated yesterday by President Petro Poroshenko and Jens Stoltenberg, as a sign that these two organizations are closer than ever. However, if you talk to anyone on the NATO side, they'll be like, we support Ukraine, and obviously we want to help them in any way we can, but they are very clear that they want this to be an arm's length relationship. Yesterday at the inauguration of this opening ceremony for the operation, Jens Stoltenberg made it very clear. He said, this is not a military exercise. He emphasized that, whereas Petro Poroshenko was perhaps going out of his way to suggest it was a bit bigger than NATO would have wanted.
What are the things that Kiev wants from NATO specifically that right now NATO is not willing to give?
Heavy weapons, that's the main thing. Everything else, actually, right now, NATO is actually willing to give Ukraine. They're willing to help them with modern communications equipment to help them in the east. They're willing to help their forces learn how to do civilian protection. They're willing to help support reform in the security sector. But Ukraine also wants heavy weapons for the fight in the east, and that is something that NATO, the organization, is not prepared to do. Whether individual NATO members are willing to do it is another matter, but NATO certainly is trying to tread this very thin, you know, very careful line, because they don't want to antagonize Russia. And when we were speaking with Jens Stoltenberg yesterday, it was, you know, we had a little press huddle for about 10 minutes at the back of the plane. It was only until the very, very end, when pushed, that he actually said the word Russia.
Why is it that they are playing what is a delicate, you know, balancing game here? Why is there not more bravado on the side of NATO? Because certainly that's what's coming from the other side of this whole argument, isn't it, from Moscow?
They're being diplomatic, and they don't want to provoke a broader conflict that they have no interest in getting involved in.
No interest, that's the key thing, isn't it?
Both, Yeah, no interest at all. So back in 2008, Georgia and Ukraine both applied to join NATO. And NATO at that time said, well, look, we like you. Yeah, definitely friends, but members of NATO, not quite so sure. Because, of course, if either of those countries had been members of NATO, and then Russia had taken the actions which it then subsequently took out in both Georgia and Ukraine, every single member of NATO would have been duty-bound by the NATO treaty to respond. And I don't think that NATO were really sort of prepared to go that far.
And talking, I suppose, of the bravado on the other side, how has this meeting, this visit, been responded to by Moscow? I suppose they could go either way. They could see it as something that is antagonistic, or they could see NATO's unwillingness to firmly commit themselves to Ukraine as being a sign of weakness on both their sides, the Ukrainian and the NATO side.
I think what's been interesting in the past few weeks is that the ceasefire in the East has not entirely held, but to a certain extent has held. Yesterday, for example, there were no casualties on either side. There were no violations, we were told, on either side. It seems like it is sort of getting to the stage where, you know, the amount of heavy fighting has certainly reduced somewhat. Russia is now seems to be turning its attention to Syria. And I must say, there is a lot of guesswork here in Kiev, both, you know, amongst the Ukrainians that we're speaking to and also NATO, about exactly what's going on in Moscow, what their game plan is, whether they actually have a game plan. And frankly, you know, everyone here is kind of guessing and waiting. But the underlying sense is right now that there's a sense of cautious optimism that there is a ceasefire, it is holding, and that the support that NATO is giving to Ukraine is, on the whole, helping out so far.
It does beg the question, though, Steve, if NATO is so worried about antagonising the situation, destabilising the situation, why do we have what, you know, limited ceremony there has been surrounding this visit by Jens Stoltenberg? Was this visit necessary?
I think so, yes, because it's a signal to Ukraine that NATO is, to a certain extent, with them. If you, and forgive me for this analogy in advance, but if you imagine Ukraine as that friend of yours who's gone on a couple of dates with a girl and is talking it up and saying it's a definite relationship, she's really into me, and then you talk to the girl and she's like, well, actually it was one day and it was fine and we're really good friends and that's probably as far as it goes. That's the state of the relationship between NATO and Ukraine right now.
That was a highlight there from The Globalist with Tyge Enright and Steve Bloomfield. Well, time now to hear from The Monocle Daily with Emma Nelson and Andrew Muller. On Wednesday, the CEOs of Apple, Amazon, IBM, Starbucks and Boeing all met the Chinese Premier Xi Jinping. He was in Seattle for the second day of his first state visit to the US. Despite its slowing economy, China still offers tremendous opportunity to American businesses, with Chinese state media reporting that China ordered 300 jets alongside plans to build a factory for finishing 737s in China. Emma Nelson and Andrew Muller spoke with our transport expert Tristan McAllister and Roderick Wai, Associate Fellow with the Asia Program at Chatham House.
I think this is China's charm offensive in the United States, seeing all these big business leaders reiterating the message that China is open for business, that the Chinese want to change their economic direction towards more consumerism. These are the very people that can exploit that and benefit from that.
Who really needs to sell what to whom here, though? Because obviously China is a massive market for all of these American corporations, but China obviously is not the easiest of places in which to do business for reasons we've talked about in this space many times before. Corruption, lack of respect for contract laws, absolutely cavalier disregard for copyrights.
These problems remain very central. And I think the part of the reason from the Chinese perspective, Xi Jinping seeing all these people, is to sort of try to reassure them that China really is open for business. And these are the kind of things that Xi Jinping was saying in his interview with the Washington Post, I think it was. but the problems remain. You know, high-tech stuff, all this worries that the US have about cyber warfare and Chinese stealing industrial secrets, those aren't going to go away, whatever nice words Xi Jinping comes up with or whatever huge contracts he comes up with.
So we have this situation, Roderick, that in business, and the tech sector in particular, appears to be possibly the greatest hope the United States and China have in maintaining sort of any kind of trusting relationship. How does this play out in the likes of what you're just talking about there, you know, belligerence in the South China Sea, this cyber hacking of 22 million US government employees by, you know, it's claimed by Chinese spies? Where does the United States and China then, and indeed the two leaders, position themselves tomorrow when they meet?
Well, I mean, on the one hand, they do have to fall back on their common ground, and their common ground is the economic relationship. That's the easy one where, you know, there's lots of, in the Chinese term, win-win. But behind that, there are these really fundamental and not easily tractable problems about the way that the Chinese government behaves and the way that the US government behaves. And neither of them are able to find a way really through that. The Chinese, of course, deny that they do any of this cyber business. The US say they do. The US say they behave perfectly reasonably, or the Chinese say they behave perfectly reasonably in the South China Sea. The US say they don't. I mean, there really is not a great meeting of minds over these issues.
Okay, we're going to bring in our resident transport expert, Tristan McAllister. Now, Tristan, it is at least a very good day for Boeing. One of the things that was announced while the Chinese president visited Everett in Washington State was that China is going to spend $38 billion to buy 300 of Boeing's aircraft.
Yeah, indeed. And it is a bit of a shot across the bow for the other big player in the world, Airbus, because up until this point, there was a 250 airplane order with customers in Asia. And now Boeing has that magic 300 number and that price tag you just said. Very big announcement. But also, coupled with that announcement today, Andrew, comes this word from Boeing and from leaders in China that they will indeed be putting a finishing facility of Boeing jets in China. This is big news because for years, Boeing's manufacturing has been kept onshore here in the U.S., and now, indeed, we will see planes being finished in China, not necessarily manufactured, but they're saying they will be painted and outfitted interiors-wise on the mainland in China, which is a huge change in the market.
Tristan McAllister and Roderick Wire there in a highlight from the Monocle Daily. Still to come on the recap, we'll head to the Croatia-Serbia border and discuss peace in Colombia with the country's ambassador to the UK. Stay tuned.
The Entrepreneurs is Monocle's weekly tour of the best companies, cleverest minds, and most visionary ideas in global business.
Genius is that little spark that makes us different from anybody that ever lived and anybody that ever will live.
From fashion to food, timepieces to tech, we shine light on the movers and shakers shaping the future of industry and commerce.
How do we continue to let companies grow, to enhance research, but at the same time make good decisions, make ethical decisions when we are in this world of uncertainty?
Tune in to hear how some of the smartest names in business got their start, where they went wrong, and how they turned it all around.
My goal was to brew the best ever Indian beer. Never sold a bottle of beer in my life, but that was my mission.
That's The Entrepreneurs, every Wednesday at 1900 hours London time, right here on Monocle 24.
Now, on Thursday, vehicles with Serbian license plates were being turned away at the Croatian border. It was the latest move in a tit-for-tat strategy between the two countries who are rowing over the ongoing migrant crisis. Some analysts say actions like this are helping plunge bilateral relations to their lowest point since the overthrow of late Serbian leader Slobodan Milosevic in 2000. Monocle's Belgrade correspondent Guy Delaunay joined Tom Edwards on The Briefing with more.
Right now, it's not good. It's very silly at the moment, I would suggest, is where the relationship is. I mean, for two supposedly friendly neighbouring countries to start closing borders, which is what Croatia did unilaterally in the first place, then Serbia blocked any Croatian freight vehicles or Croatian-made goods from coming through as of today, because earlier this week, this was when Croatia closed the border. That was Serbia's measure. Now, of course, Croatia has responded by blocking any Serbian vehicles from going into Croatia. Well, it all does seem a bit playground, really, doesn't it? And I think that's about the level of it.
So, well, let me ask you then, Guy, I mean, is this being sparked by this crisis? Is it because of the pressure that that's bringing to bear? Or are there other things in the background? You know, it's a always a very complex picture throughout the region. Is it more about the past or things in the background, or is it about the crisis?
I think we can look at the here and now for the most part, Tom. I mean, what's happened with Croatia is in the space of a week, it had 50,000 refugees come over its border from Serbia and giving it a very awkward situation, one which Croatia, frankly, should have planned for, because anybody could have seen that coming when Hungary started building their fence and it became obvious that Hungary was serious about their fence. Well, it was pretty obvious that the next place refugees were going to go would be Croatia. Croatia wasn't well enough prepared. It struggled, and it's trying to blame other people for its own problems, I would suggest. This move really, and they've made no secret about this, it's trying to use the borders as leverage to get Serbia to direct refugees in other directions, namely Hungary and Romania. The fact of the matter is, Hungary doesn't look like a very welcoming place for refugees coming from Serbia. Neither does Romania. It's an untested route, and you've got to go the long way round. It's not in the Schengen area, and it hasn't got a good reputation either. So, you know, convincing refugees to go those ways might be a tricky task.
Guy, let me just ask you about Serbia and, you know, prospective EU membership. Does this sort of dynamics that we're seeing and what's playing out here, could it influence that? Well, I don't know, certainly might influence the outcome, but does it influence the debate perhaps? Is that a factor?
I think Serbia, until now, during this refugee crisis, had done nothing but good to its chances of accelerating its EU membership negotiations. It had received praise from the European Union, from ambassadors like the German ambassador, who, of course, the most important, among the most important to please during these negotiations, because it had handled the refugee crisis fairly well and behaved, and these were the quotes from the EU and Germany, in a way befitting of an EU member state. This sort of little tit-for-tat row is Serbia and Croatia behaving in ways which are not really like European Union states at all, at least not how they'd like to be. We've also seen, as these negotiations have started with Serbia, the other countries can add sort of riders to negotiation chapters. And guess which country, Tom, has added the most riders to the negotiations?
Well, I almost don't want to, Guy.
Croatia,
indeed.
It is trying to make life hard for its neighbour, no matter what it's saying about relations having improved, no matter the fact that, you know, heads of state and foreign ministers are exchanging bilateral visits. Croatia is trying to make it harder for Serbia to join the European Union.
That was Monocle's Belgrade correspondent Guy Delaunay there, speaking to Tom Edwards in a snippet from The Briefing on Thursday. Well, time's nearly up on this week's show, but before we take off, let's wrap the week up with another moment from The Briefing, this time from Friday's edition. Colombia and the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, or FARC, signed a peace agreement this week, ending the longest-running insurgency in Latin America. Since the 1960s, the government has been at odds with the FARC. President Juan Manuel Santos said the groundwork was being laid for a final peace accord, pardons and amnesties for 15,000 people, including fighters and civilian militia members involved in political crimes. Monocle's Georgina Godwin sat down with Colombia's ambassador to the UK and former rotating president of the UN Security Council, Néstor Osorio Londono. She began by asking if this is truly a path to peace as it's being built.
The characteristic of this process is that it has been systematically and orderly conducted. From the secret negotiations that took place for the space of 7 months between Colombian envoys and FARC representatives, to the establishment of the 5 points of an agenda, and to the, I will say, discipline with which the process have been conducted step by step, expediting the agreements about the different issues that have been specified in the agenda. I think that there are reasons to believe that this is not just an attempt, but it is a real and concrete effort that is being given some results along these 3 years of negotiation.
This conflict's been unfolding since the 1960s. Was there one breakthrough moment, do you think, that's led to this or will lead to this agreement?
Well, one of the issues here to be considered is that since 2000, I will say, the action of the government and the action of the military forces of Colombia against the FARC was a very substantive one, a very robust one, and the government managed to diminish substantially the capacity of the FARC to operate. They managed to sustain themselves thanks for a very important part of their activities, thanks to the kidnapping of people and then to the drug trafficking. And that was a decisive issue that allowed them to be effective and to be more durable in the fight in the insurgency. So I think the moment they felt that there was not a war that they could win, then the foundations for peace conversations were established. And the government has the tact to do it in a way that they could come to a table of negotiations and not only just to lay the arms and to appear as defeated.
We know that the continuing talks focus on big areas, major points such as land reform, rebels, political participation, the elimination of illegal crops of drugs, the rights of victims. How would a final agreement be enforced? It's so massive.
Yeah, the crucial point is an agreement on what kind of justice and what extension of that justice to allow peace to be signed. From the very beginning, we knew that to get an agreement about the acceptance of the guerrillas to be subject to a kind of punishment, to submit themselves to a tribunal, was going to be very difficult, because they were preaching all the time that their movement was just a political response to what they thought that was an oppression from the state, and that their legitimate aspiration was to have an amnesty or a general indulto, as could be called. But this was, as the negotiation on this matter developed, a very clear point that the government and the Colombian people were not prepared to accept impunity. That we were not, and the victims, and this is the context in which the system of justice is construed, is that the victim reparation and the victim satisfaction is at the center of the implementation of a justice system. So the creation of the special jurisdiction for peace that and some specific tribunals to deal with the different matters is a very important step. It is the step at which the FARC recognized that their actions could be subject to some kind of punishment. And there is a clear division here between those crimes that could be qualified as political crimes and all those that will have some connexity with this, and the crimes against humanity. The crimes against humanity that will be determined by those tribunals are not going to be subject of any amnesty. And crimes that could have some legal qualification will be subject to prison from 5 to 8 years for those who recognize that some faults have been committed. Those who do not recognize that they have indulged in criminal acts and are proven to be committed, they could risk a prison of 20 years. So this is a clear legal tariff, if you want, about what will be the way those tribunals will be conducted.
That was Colombia's ambassador to the UK, Néstor Osorio Londono, speaking to Monocle's Georgina Godwin. And that just about brings us to the end of this week's episode of The Recap. The show was produced by Carlotta Ribello and edited by Nina Norick and Weidong Lin. Join us again next week to hear some of the very best of our live news programs broadcast here on Monocle 24. But for now, from me, Ben Ryland, thanks for listening. Goodbye.